a monologue or song from my show. Bonnie Bruckheimer, who went from Bette's assistant to her producing partner, told me I was one of the few people who could make Bette laugh out loud in those days. Bette was sort of an introvert and could come across as removed, even shy. You knew when she did or did not want to engage. You didn't have to guess her mood. We'd all been drinking one night after the show, and Bette said to me, "Jennifer," she still says my name like that, "you don't want this, Jennifer. This shit is too hard." But my idol was wrong. I did want it. I wanted those 10,000 voices in the arena to be cheering for me. Detour 83 was sort of a mixture of rock and roll meets Broadway. We did 46 cities in about 3 months. It was incredibly fabulous, but exhausting, even for my 26-year-old body. The show included several big high camp numbers, including Pink Cadillac. We also performed one of Bette's torch songs, Here Comes the Flood, as well as the anthem, We Are Family. There were elaborate costumes and sets with ramps, levels, and one scene where we wore mermaid fins and rolled ourselves around in wheelchairs. I did my specialty, hula hooping, and had to learn to play the accordion. We harlots rehearsed endlessly, mastering the tight vocal harmonies required to back up that. I fought with the other harlots, Siobhan O'Carroll and Helena Springs. We three were replacing the harlots who had done the wintertime portion of Detour. There was plenty of drama. You know, stupid shit. Once I threw my hula hoop during rehearsal and had to apologize the next day. In the limo, we usually shared a limo as we traveled from the airport to our hotels. I guess I was too loud or teased too much, because eventually Bonnie and the rest requested my silence. On one occasion, I needled Helena to the brink, and she jumped out of the moving car. We were going very slowly, and she wasn't hurt. Journal entry. I am a monster. Franny the dresser said to me, "Jennifer, you gotta get over this shit, 'cause it'll kill Bette." Fortunately, our makeup artist, Geneva Nash, had a loving but stern way of settling my ass down. Bette was a class act, but this was a rock and roll tour, so there was plenty of sex and drugs. In general, we were a pretty wild bunch. Bette's collaborator, Jerry Blatt, who I loved very much, had pink hair. I sported a crazy mohawk. We had a rollicking time, but Bette never allowed our antics to compromise the show's professionalism. Believe me, we all snapped to attention when the divine Miss M arrived. The tour started out in Philly and East Coast locations. When we got to Saratoga Springs in upstate New York, I had sex against a sugar maple tree with Ed Love, the choreographer. A few days later, he showed up backstage with another girl. So that was that. Until we got to Montreal a couple of weeks later, and I had a menage a trois with Ed and Billy, with whom I toured in UB. I also had sex with one of the band members, but his enormous penis stayed soft. Too much cocaine. The day we opened in Boston, I went ballistic because someone forgot to put VIP tickets aside for Timmy, Billy, and their friend June. I pulled a full-out diva tantrum, banging on Bette's trailer door, crying and whining. She barged out of the trailer half made up, hair flying, robe flapping, and shouted at the assistant, "Get her 4 fucking tickets in the front row! The last time," she cried, "she fell off the fucking ramp." It's true. I did have a few gaffes on stage, like in Costa Mesa, where I fucked up the whole mermaids in wheelchairs routine. If Bette got irritated with me, she rarely showed it. When the tour got to Newport, Rhode Island, I asked Bette to sign my Detour 83 poster. She wrote, "To the greatest black entertainer who ever lived, I am the white one." Bette knew I was loyal and that I wanted to be the best for the show. I think by this time she suspected I had deep emotional problems, but I also think she saw a bit of herself in me. I felt she kind of took care of me in her own way. I only wish that I had been able to pull my shit together this first time we worked together. When all is said and done, Bette Midler probably had a greater impact on me than anyone else I have worked with. She polished my game and upped it several notches. She validated me and confirmed what I knew about my talent, especially the fact that Jennifer motherfucking Lewis does not belong in the chorus. Be it a harlot, icat, or ronnet. Honestly, though, the experience of observing Bette's artistry and getting to know her as a loving friend made it all worth it. Toward the end of the tour, Bette gave me a wonderful gift of original sheet music from an old Ethel Waters song. In turn, I gifted Bette a black Raggedy Ann doll. She named it Killer. Prince came to see Detour at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles. During the after party at Spargo on Sunset, I found him in the back in the dark. I approached him. He extended his hand, which was swathed in a black lace glove. At first, I thought he expected me to kiss it. Instead, I gripped his hand firmly, but got grossed out when I felt the sweaty moistness of his palm through the lace. Unfortunately, because I was so focused on my own glory, I did not take the opportunity to engage with this master. Damn. Prince and I met again 26 years later backstage at the first final Jay Leno show in 2009. I said, "Hey, Prince, I'm Jennifer." He smiled and said, "I know who you are." Then he turned to his beautiful companion and said, "Yeah, she's funny all the time." I get tingles just thinking about it. In September, we did our final show in Minneapolis. The entire company sprayed their hair pink for closing night. I fucked an Italian guy named Frank in my dressing room. The party was over. Nearly 15 years after we toured together, I was still foolishly competing with Bette. I flew to Las Vegas to see Bette in her show called Diva Las Vegas. I went to her dressing room after the show and started clowning, telling jokes, and singing loudly. Bette asked me, "Jennifer, why are you performing?" I said, "Well, didn't you just perform?" She said, "Yeah, but I got paid." I shut the fuck up. Touring as a harlot with Bette had put me in greater demand. I was happy to finally start getting the attention for my work that I felt I deserved. I was asked to do a one-woman show at popular venues in New York City, such as Sweetwater's, Freddy's, and the Red Parrot. I was everywhere. The performance at Sweetwater's earned one of the few bad reviews I've ever gotten. The writer for Variety said, among other things, that I used too many props to get my point across. Journal entry: "Kiss my black ass." I actually found the review meaningful. I learned something about simplicity from the critic. Small things such as knowing when and how to use your body alone to convey a message makes the difference between an amateur and a professional. I did a New Year's Eve show at Don't Tell Mama. I knew I had to be good that night. It cost $50 to get in, and that was a big deal. I woke up on New Year's Day, 1984, with my head banging and my face feeling like it was made of cement. Peter, a bassist I had been flirting with, called at 6 a.m. to wish me Happy New Year. I went back to sleep till 2 p.m. when Tyrone came by. We watched the Orange Bowl and, well, let's just say Tyrone made it to the end zone more than once. He was going down on me during halftime when Peter and Ken called. And yes, to answer your question, I picked up both times. I loved to push the limits. Fucking one guy while talking to two others was a complete power trip for me. Thomas called twice and hung up before finally leaving a message. The neighbor next door banged on the wall and shouted for us to keep it down. Being in my 20s, how could I possibly keep it down? June, a friend of my friend Timmy in Boston, introduced me to an agent in Washington, D.C. named Jim Kepler, who owned a successful speakers bureau. Kepler encouraged me to develop a solo show that he could book at colleges during Black History Month. I started to work on an idea for a one-woman show called From Billy to Lena with Jennifer that would pay tribute to great African-American women singers whose lives and art had inspired me. I spent weeks doing research at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem. Every contemporary African-American singer, Toni Braxton, Beyoncé, Rihanna, and of course my Lil Brandy, stands on the shoulders of genius women whose artistry and struggle I feared were becoming lost in the tide of history. I chose seven women: Billie Holiday, Ethel Waters, Mahalia Jackson, Dinah Washington, Aretha Franklin, Tina Turner, and Lena Horne. God knows I wanted to include them all: Gladys, Nina, Patty, Natalie. But the show was only 1 hour long. I listened to dozens of songs written or recorded by each singer, ultimately choosing not their most popular song, but the songs that seemed to offer special meaning for the singer or that gave insight into their character. For instance, rather than Tina's Proud Mary, I sang Show Some Respect. And whereas Billy's Strange Fruit had become iconic, instead I sang Tain't Nobody's Business If I Do. Mahalia laid the foundation for gospel music with Take My Hand, Precious Lord, but instead I chose to sing Trouble of the World. Years later, on the set of Touched by an Angel, Della Reese, who was close with Mahalia, told me that this was in fact the perfect song. It was not my goal to imitate the singing styles of my subjects in From Billy to Lena. Instead, I sang the songs my way while framing them with monologues that dramatized the women's lives and struggles. The show was pretty serious, even somber, especially when I spoke of the hardships and racism the women had faced. But there were plenty of fun parts, too, like during Dinah's Evil Gal Blues, when I splayed myself onto the piano, threw one leg in the air, and sang, I'm an evil gal, don't you mess around with me, 'cause I'm gonna empty your pockets and fill you with misery. Dinah had seven mink coats and always carried a gun. In February 1984, I took to the road with From Billy to Lena with Jennifer. My first booking was at North Greenville University, a small Christian university in North Carolina. It was literally the first time I had performed before an audience made up entirely of strangers. No gypsies, no relatives, no fans. Was I really as good as I thought? Who would start the applause? I hardly even knew Billy McDaniels, my genius pianist. It was quite possibly the first time I was actually nervous before going on stage. The show was well received. Mark Brown co-wrote the show's monologues, and I am eternally grateful to him for creating a meaningful show that entertained and educated college audiences for a full decade of Black History Months. After every performance, I held a question and answer session with the students. This was my favorite part because I got to relax and just be myself. There might be a question or two about the show, but mostly the students wanted to hear about how I had made it. I must have seemed like an exotic bird to these college kids, with my big 80s hair teased to the ceiling, my sequin gold lamé Don Klein jumpsuit, caked blue eyeshadow, and extreme liquid black eyeliner. Many of the students came from small rural towns and had never visited New York or met a professional entertainer. I enjoyed sharing with them what I had learned and seen of the world. I wanted them to know the importance of finding their passion, working hard to fulfill their dreams, being good citizens, and above all, giving back to those less fortunate. I crisscrossed the United States doing From Billy to Lena with Jennifer, mostly at rural schools. Billy and I flew in raggedy propeller planes that served small cities. I always did my best to go through St. Louis to gorge on some of Mama's fried jack salmon with spaghetti before I had to catch my flight on Allegheny or Ozark Airlines. Attending services at Unity and listening to Phil Valentine had expanded my thinking, and I began to explore spirituality on my own. I really wanted to become more connected and to understand life outside of show business. To that end, I experimented with everything that was part of the New Age movement. Being among artists meant that I was exposed to all sorts of new ideas. Artists are discontent by nature. We are thrill seekers who are hip and in the know, and are often the first to open up to new ways of thinking. Unity's philosophy of say yes, which had resonated so deeply for me, evolved into a general appreciation for positive thinking after reading The Greatest Salesman by Og Mandino. The book moved me to think about the possibility that I, not some unseen force, was in control of my life. I began to practice the breath of fire technique in Kundalini yoga class and learned to sit still long enough to meditate. No easy task for me, I assure you. Perhaps the most important book for me at the time was Out on a Limb by Shirley MacLaine, in which she chronicled her exploration of New Age spirituality. The book brought ridicule to MacLaine for her talk of aliens and trance channeling. In her speech after winning the Golden Globe Award for Best Actress for her role in Terms of Endearment, MacLaine said, "If you can dream it, you can make it happen." I was hooked. Shirley was famous, and I wanted her recipe for success. Fast forward to 2000. I walked on stage for one of my one-woman shows and immediately spotted a head full of red hair sitting sixth row center. It was Shirley MacLaine. Need I say, I performed my ass off that night. I wasted no time at the end of the show pointing out that she was indeed in the house and had been an influence on me and my spiritual journey. When she came backstage after the show, she embraced me, pulled back, and held me by the shoulders and said, "That was the best show I've seen, ever." I wrinkled my face a little, thinking, "Sinatra? Sammy? Judy? Me?" And then she repeated herself. "Ever." She said something else I'll never forget. "Your landscapes are vast." Well, let's just say after that, I never gave a flying fuck what anybody had to say about anything. After Shirley's amazing compliment, she invited me to walk with her on the beach early the next morning. Trust me, I wouldn't get up that early for nobody but Shirley MacLaine and her dog. She said to me, "Before we start, Jennifer, I have one question for you. Why aren't you the biggest star in the world?" I looked at her and said, "I am the biggest star in the world." I knew she understood. I was beyond excited to be cast as a featured performer in Harlem Story, which was conceived by Peter Herbolzheimer, a German arranger and conductor known for bringing American jazz artists to perform with his orchestra in Cologne, West Germany. Harlem Story was a musical review of works written or recorded by African-American jazz and gospel artists. A producer friend assembled an impressive company of gypsies and Broadway actors, including Claire Bethay, Vondi Curtis Hall, Connie Brazelton, Ty Stevens, Yolanda Graves, and Roxanne Reese. I soloed in a scene featuring songs made famous by Bessie Smith and a medley of songs by Hubie Blake. It was wonderful to be away from New York City. I strolled along the Rhine River and visited the city's Gothic Cologne Cathedral. On the downside, I found German food inedible and mostly ate at McDonald's. I seriously thought about remaining in Europe to do the whole Josephine Baker thing. She was the first black person to become a world-famous entertainer and to star in a movie. In the 1920s, Baker fled American racism and became the toast of Paris. But never being good with languages, I took my ass back to New York. I wrote a series of shows with Mark Brown and David Hodegrivey, including Jennifer Lewis in the Cosmos, which was a celebration and a send-up of my spiritual search. We three also wrote Jennifer Lewis Broke and Freaking Out, which is self-explanatory. Unlike my earlier solo endeavors, these shows had a through line, and thanks to Mark, a lot of commentary about current events and politics. I also unveiled characters such as Little Jenny Lewis and a Baptist pastor. The shows at Don't Tell Mama were mostly sold out Tuesdays through Saturday nights. The 8 o'clock show usually was filled with tourists. The 11 o'clock show would be filled with savvy New Yorkers and Broadway gypsies who'd just come off stage at whatever show they were performing. The Dreamgirls gypsies came damn near every night. Occasionally, I'd get an out-of-town booking at places such as the Trafalmador in Buffalo, New York, and the Pilgrim House in Provincetown, Massachusetts. I did private parties in the Poconos, and even went back to Kinloch for a Homegirl Makes Good concert. I was asked to do a benefit performance for an age charity at Studio 54. The legendary disco was just a block from where I lived, but it was my first time there, and it would be my last. I was there to work. I didn't go to clubs to socialize, not disco clubs anyway. I wore a silver lamé jumpsuit designed by Don Klein and a big, fabulous vampirous mask. The famous husband and wife comedy duo Stilla and Mira introduced me on stage to perform Blackuella. It went a little something like this. Da-na-na-na-na. My name is Blackuella, and you are my prey. Don't tell me you gave at the office, cause I don't drink during the day. I hope you're without a date tonight. You want me to tell you why? Cause I'm gonna pick you up and dust you off, then drain you till you're dry. Why? I'm a vampirist, baby. V-A-M-P-I-R-E-S-S. John Voight, who had won the Best Actor Oscar a few years earlier, was in the audience that night, and I could see him eyeing me. Later, he asked me to dance, and we did, scandalously, to Annie Lennox's Sweet Dreams. At the end of the night, John and I walked to Central Park and took a romantic carriage ride. We admired the moon and the reflection of the illuminated skyline off the lake. We talked about being from families of hard workers. We stared into each other's eyes and kissed. We went to his room on the 35th floor of the Essex House. I was spellbound by his sensitivity and kindness. He ordered cognac and caviar. Let's just say he was a real midnight cowboy. He walked me the 6 blocks to my apartment the next morning. I wanted so badly for one of the gypsies to see me with John Voight, but honey, gypsies don't get up that early. I began to develop a more mature, professional performance. I had learned so much from Bette, like the technique of getting the audience laughing hard and then changing the mood on a dime and dropping some knowledge. And I found myself comfortable enough to start improvising based on what was going on with the audience. I'd give latecomers sass from the stage. Hey, what time did your ticket say? You missed my first 3 numbers, which I did naked. If you've ever seen one of my stage shows, then you know I love to fuck with everybody. Jennifer, to the audience member returning to her seat from the ladies' room. You there in the red dress. Everything taken care of? Audience member, completely baffled and embarrassed. Huh? Jennifer, could you still hear me in the ladies' room? You know they have a speaker in there. Audience member, now playing along. No, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Jennifer, well, we heard you. But don't get it wrong, I am no Don Rickles. For the most part, I am the butt of my own jokes. It was nothing for me to walk the halls of my apartment building looking to bum a cigarette. With my head wrapped and wearing a fuzzy robe, I'd knock on a neighbor's door regardless of whether I knew them. One time when I knocked on a strange door, it was opened by the Hollywood musical star Jane Powell. I immediately recognized her, and after chatting a bit, I invited myself into her penthouse. She was gracious and lovely and told me I was a sweet girl. Thank goodness she didn't live next door to my loud ass. One day I knocked on 4 D. A cute guy answered the door and soon produced a cigarette. "You got a light?" I asked, and he presented a lighter. Then I said, "I'm Jennifer Lewis. I'm a diva. We'll have to meet again when it's not so morning and not so ugly." A couple of weeks later, the guy and I were riding the same elevator. This time, I was in full beat and dressed to kill. When he made eye contact with me, I said, "See?" That was how I met Lee Summers, a wonderful friend, actor, and singer. He was in the original cast of Dreamgirls. One of our favorite things to do together was people watching, like the time we were sitting at an outdoor cafe and saw a man running away from a taxi driver he had stiffed for a fare. Poor bastard slipped and fell on his face, and in unison we sang, "Karma, Karma Jackson, that bitch'll get you every time." Then we fell out with laughter. It didn't take me long to know that I loved Lee and his singing voice. When the opportunity arose to headline for a week at a swank club in Monte Carlo, Monaco, I wasted no time asking him to join me singing backup with a friend, Todd Hunter, an amazing dancer. Monaco was memorable for a number of reasons. I had even met Grace Kelly's son, Prince Albert, who is currently the small country's reigning monarch. But Monaco will always stand out for me because I was there when the AIDS crisis really broke open in the U.S. media. One day I decided to go ahead and sleep with the club's gorgeous maitre d' after the night show. Then someone phoned and told me that Luther Vandross had AIDS. He had lost a lot of weight, and as a result, the rumor was born. During this period, people were paranoid. Anyone who had lost weight or suddenly fell ill was rumored to have the virus. Nonetheless, when I heard that, oh, did I put on the brakes on the maitre d'. I had heard someone on the news say something to the effect of, "Whomever you've slept with, you have essentially slept with everyone they slept with for the last 7 years." I said to a friend, "Honey, I want you to book me a flight around the world. Put it on a credit card, because I am a dead bitch." Of course, I had been aware of HIV/AIDS for some time. The plague had hit the entertainment community, especially the world of gay black gypsies, like a freight train. In these years, you knew what was coming when yet another call began with, "Sit down, Jennifer, I have some bad news." It started slowly at first. Curtis Worthy Jr., a castmate from Mahalia, passed away. A couple of months later, Jerry Grimes, a dancer I knew through Shirley Black Brown, died. Then we bore helpless witness as our friends started to die, 2 or 3 a week. For God's sake, they dropped like flies. Another dancer, another hairstylist, another costume designer. By now, I understood that the rare form of pneumonia that killed Wilby Abel was no longer rare, and that he was among the nation's earliest victims of AIDS. By the time I returned from doing my show in Monaco, the entire United States was in an uproar. President Reagan had finally mentioned AIDS publicly for the first time, but the sons of bitches in the government did almost nothing to address or remedy the situation. probably because it was mostly gay men, drug users, and poor people who were dying. But then Americans began to freak out when it became clear that heterosexuals, women, and children were also at risk. I recall watching Ted Koppel's town hall on the AIDS crisis. We were glued to the television. Come on, you son of a bitches, do something! It was a horrible time. The following month, the legendary creator of Dreamgirls, Michael Bennett, died. The Broadway community was devastated. And groups like Equity Fights AIDS and Broadway Cares were organized to raise money and to push the government to do more for AIDS research and treatment, to try to alleviate our feelings of helplessness. My friends and I came up with an idea called Divas for Dollars. For several Saturday nights, when the gay spots were jumping, a few of us gypsies, including Sharon McKnight, Karen Mason, Lena Katrakis, Nancy Lamott, and Amy Ryder, popped in to perform a couple of songs before we passed the hat for AIDS relief and research. It wasn't much, but I like to think that we made a difference. I cursed at God as the AIDS toll mounted. And not just in New York City. During Black History Month, when I toured the college circuit with From Billy to Lena with Jennifer, I was often asked back by the same schools year after year. Usually when I'd arrive in a small town to perform at the local campus, I'd immediately go to the black hair salon, hoping to find a gay man who would appreciate my divaness and get my hair teased up and snatched for the show. But far too often, I'd return to a salon I'd used the previous year, only to learn the sole gay male stylist had passed away. The plague had reached small-town America. It was relentless and horrible. The reality of just how many friends and colleagues of mine were very sick or had passed away was overwhelming. The relentless epidemic claimed nearly 200 of my friends and co-workers in the span of about 11 years. Roderick Seibert and Breelam Daniels from the UB Tour, Tony Franklin and Larry Stewart from the Dreamgirls original cast, Philip Gilmore from the Dreamgirls Broadway revival, Jerry Blatt and Ed Love from Detour 83, Carl Weaver from Rock and Roll the First 5,000 Years. Three of my favorite hairstylists, Stanley Crow, Jerry Terrell, and Michael Robinson, Sharon Redd, who had been a harlot in the 70s, Robert Melvin, Stanley Ingram, Chris Vaughn, Keith McDaniel, Martin McChesney, Craig Frawley. There are just too many to name. The trauma of their suffering and their untimely and unnecessary deaths haunts me to this very day. In late January, Quitman gave me the terrible news he was leaving New York City for San Francisco. I went all the way off. A screaming, crying, snot-filled breakdown. He said he was going out west to find someone to produce the musical he'd been working on for years. I cussed him out for losing hope and leaving. I didn't know what I would do without him nearby. Quitman was always in my heart and on my mind. Had I paid more attention a few weeks earlier, when Quitman told me the doctor had found nodules on his neck, I would have understood the real reason he felt the need to be in San Francisco, which had become a mecca for HIV research and treatment. Throughout the next few years, he would be in and out of the hospital, very ill. And he was deeply depressed. I remember calling him to tell him how well things were going with a series I was working on, Crosstown. But he was not in the mood. He didn't want to hear about how I was doing all the things he had dreamed of doing, which now we both knew he would never do. I tried to raise Quitman's mood. Changing subjects, I began to regale him with stories of all the guys I'd been dating in Hollywood. He cut me off. "Stop it, Jennifer. I don't want to hear about all the sex you're having." I was so sad for him and for myself. I didn't know what to say. I was working hard and looked forward to the still, almost daily silent phone call from Quitman. God, how I loved him. We laughed and cried together as always. Around Christmas time, I remember discussing the death of Sylvester, the gay disco music icon, at only age 41. A couple of days later, we repeated the call. But this time, it was Max Robinson, the first African-American anchor of a national news program, cut down at age 49. One morning in early January, the bedside phone jarred me awake at 3 a.m. Quitman spoke slowly, the fear in his voice nearly palpable. "I'm in the hospital, Jen. I'm sick. This time I think I'm real sick." My friend Beverly Heath drove most of the nearly 8 hours it took to reach the hospital in Oakland. The nurse told me not to touch or hug Quitman. Confusion still remained about how the HIV virus was spread. I entered the dimly lit room where Quitman lay still in the bed. This Adonis, this god, whose body could leap as high as Mount Everest, lay there, covered in purple lesions. I stepped forward and touched Quitman's face and took his hands. He whispered, "Oh, Jen, you're the first person to touch me without wearing gloves in 2 years." I held myself together long enough to laugh and joke with Quitman a little. The nurses would not allow me to stay in the room for more than a few minutes. By the time I got to the parking lot, I was falling apart. I saw red, then I saw black. Because all I could see was death. In the car, I screamed, clutching my chest and banging the dashboard. I asked Beverly to drive me to a liquor store where I walked around like I was shopping for shoes. My eyes fell on a bottle of Wild Turkey, which I'd never heard of but bought anyway. Back in the car, I turned the bottle up and chugged the burning liquid. Needing to erase the image of my friend rotting to death. As we drove to the home of Beverly's friend, where we would spend the night, Beverly said, "You're grieving, Jennifer. And I understand, baby. But there's something more. Something's wrong." I was too distraught to make conversation with the lovely couple who were opening their home to us. As Beverly stirred the gumbo dinner, I dialed the kitchen wall phone to call Mark and Bobby in New York to tell them about Quitman. But before I could even say a word, Mark blurted, "Jenny, I'm glad it's you. Clyde Vincent died." Clyde had been my acting coach a few years earlier in New York. It was all too much. I collapsed to the floor and crawled under the kitchen table, holding myself in a ball, sobbing into my knees. Beverly calmly looked down at me as she continued to stir with the long wooden spoon. "Beverly, gently. What are you doing under the table, Jenny?" Me, looking up and screaming. "I don't know. Don't leave me. Just don't leave me." Beverly, a bit less gentle. "Jenny, get your ass up off this floor." Me, "I can't. I can't move, Beverly." Beverly, "Jenny, you gotta listen to me, baby. Something's going on with you. Really, this is something more than sadness about Quitman. You need to get professional help with this. You need to talk to somebody." Me, starting to gain composure. "Really? You think it will help me, Beverly?" Beverly, "I know it will, baby. There's no greater journey than the journey within." Quitman's illness and the near constant news of another friend stricken by AIDS caused me to channel my grief into many AIDS causes. Over the years, I launched at least a dozen AIDS walks and performed at numerous fundraisers. No doubt there has been progress on the AIDS front, but it saddens me that many people, gay and straight, continue to get the disease. The struggle isn't over. 8. Hollywood Not Swinging. My friend Louis St. Louis, who has been truly important to my career, came through for me in a big way. Louis was well connected in show business circles and invited agents from William Morris to Don't Tell Mama to see me in my one-woman show, How I Spent My Summer Vacation. And yes, the biggest talent agency in the business signed me immediately. Finally, my big break. In short order, William Morris arranged auditions for a Broadway show, a couple of movies, and a screen test for Bonnie Timmerman, who at the time was the casting director for Universal. But I didn't get cast in anything. After I auditioned for Grind, a Broadway-bound musical starring Ben Vereen, the director, Hal Prince, commented, I was too powerful to be real. This feedback actually made me smile. My early days with William Morris underscored my persistent dilemma of not fitting into a marketable box. I was too unconventional, not commercial enough. One of my William Morris agents, Greg Mullins, told me I needed to be more glamorous. What the fuck did he mean by that? The agency sent me on several auditions for roles that I knew could take my career to the next level. I auditioned for the role of Shug in the movie The Color Purple. I was hugely disappointed that Reuben Cannon, the casting director, felt I was too young. It was sort of nice to hear that, because in show business, having large breasts usually means they cast you as characters that are 10 years older than your age. Then came the audition for Saturday Night Live. In its 10 seasons on the air, SNL had featured only one African-American woman, an actress named Yvonne Hudson. Excitement does not describe how I felt. This could be it. An opportunity to show my versatility, vocal ability, comic timing, and charisma. Nora Dunn was auditioning that same day. I must have done well, because a day or so later, I got a call back and met the show's creator, Lorne Michaels. Then, a few days later, my agent, Lucy Aceto, called to tell me, with great compassion, that I had not gotten SNL. If one real test of a person's mental health is their ability to experience rejection and great disappointment, then not surprisingly, I failed the test. I fell the fuck apart. I staggered to the Sheep Meadow in Central Park. As soon as I got there, I dropped to my knees, sobbing, and fell face first into the grass. Damn, that hurt. I lost control of my body, shaking, writhing, and crying out. I lay there and cried until nightfall. By morning, my sorrow had turned to rage. I stormed the few blocks to the William Morris building on 55th Street, blew past the secretary, and burst into Lucy's office, pounding on her desk, screaming and shouting blindly. I blamed the agency for misguiding me. I know I scared the shit out of everyone in the nearby offices. I was lucky William Morris didn't drop me on the spot. The SNL role went to Denitra Vance, a talented actress who lasted through only one season. Frustrated by the stereotypical parts given her on the show, Denitra left SNL in 1986. Although auditioning was getting me nowhere, my cabaret shows were still in great demand and provided me with a creative outlet that kept me from completely losing my mind. In the audience one July evening at Don't Tell Mama was Bob Wax, the founder of the comic strip in New York City. Wax had discovered Eddie Murphy, and Bob's other clients, Arsenio Hall and Chris Rock, were bursting onto the entertainment scene. Bob loved my show, believed in my talent, and felt that as my manager, he could take my career to new heights. Finally, my knight in shining armor had arrived. I was now where I had hoped to be. In addition to Bob Wax, heavy hitters, including the Zippels, were fighting for me. But as months of auditions rolled by without success, it was still not clear where my niche was. I didn't fit on Wax's roster like the others. He knew what to do for them, but my offering was too broad and uniquely individual. Mark Brown heard me say I was going crazy, waiting for my big break. He had started seeing a therapist and knew I could benefit from therapy, too. But rather than do that, we devised a new show, Jennifer Lewis on the Couch, in which I spoke to an unseen shrink and analyzed why I wasn't a star yet. David Zippel and Joanne Zippel were the producers, backed by a full band and two muscle-bound singers named Keith McDaniel and Craig Frawley, I opened Jennifer Lewis on the Couch at the Roundabout Theater in April. This was big. The Roundabout was a real theater, not a cabaret. The show was a hit with critics and audiences, and even won me a spot on the Today Show, where I was interviewed by Jane Pauley, who was very pregnant at the time. I wore a beautiful white suit and added some dangly gold earrings my mother had given me the Christmas before. Jane Pauley, smugly. "So, Jennifer, are you ever going to be a star? When do you think it will happen?" Jennifer, I don't know. I guess when I'm calmer." Jane Pauley, "Well, maybe it will happen when the earrings are real." "Excuse me? I know this woman did not just insult me on national television." I was stunned by her rudeness. Later, I thought she must have had morning sickness or something. But fuck that. Now that I have the opportunity, let me just say, Ms. Pauly, that was rude. And by the way, I did become a star. And trust me, the earrings are fucking real. At the urging of Bob Wax, my new manager, I decided to move to L.A. I'd been in 3 Broadway shows and made a name for myself as a solo performer. Now it was time for Hollywood, for movies, TV, Oscars, and Grammys. Bob bought me a used Mazda 323, and I had saved $6,000 from my Billy Talina tour to cover me during what I thought would be a brief period before I achieved stardom. I moved in with Roxanne Reese, who had remained a friend after our concert in Cologne, at her small bungalow apartment on Troost Avenue, deep in the San Fernando Valley. Rox was working steadily in TV and as Richard Pryor's opening act. Bob put me in the hands of his assistant, Tess Haley. Right off the bat, Tess commissioned a highly respected writer named Deborah Dean Davis to create a movie script for me, which Bob could shop to the studios. Although the script got no mileage, Deborah and I became bosom buddies. Bob was a powerful player whose client roster easily opened Hollywood's gates. He got me meetings with every major studio in town. Opportunity seemed to be banging on my door when Bob arranged for a showcase for me at the Comedy Store and filled the audience with Hollywood bigwigs. One of these was George Schlatter, the legendary producer who had transformed American television comedy in the late 1960s with Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. Schlatter loved me, but once again, he found me unmarketable. He told me, if this was 20 years ago, you would be a star overnight. To this day, I believe this is true. Unlike the bygone 50s and 60s when multi-talented performers like Flip Wilson, Carol Burnett, and Jackie Gleason reigned, show business in the 80s was designed to market artists who fit in a simple box, comic or singer or actor or sexy starlet. I was all of those! Yet, I persisted. I cast my net wider, auditioning for the movie Beetlejuice, to be a VJ on VH1, for a Fritos commercial, and for a CBS series called Sirens. I was rejected over and over. Bob set up meetings with Paramount, Columbia Pictures, and Lorimar, the highly successful company that produced Dallas, Knott's Landing, and Falcon Crest. After the meeting at Paramount, I was driving off the studio lot when I saw Chris Rock walking in the blazing California sun. I pulled up and, like back home in the Midwest, leaned out the car window and asked, "Wanna ride, Negro?" We acted a fool in my little white Mazda until I dropped him off at his hotel. I auditioned for the lead in Clara's Heart, but Whoopi got the role. I auditioned for a role in the movie Scrooged, and all I got for that was Felt Up by crazy-ass Bill Murray. All in good fun, but I got the hell out of there. I also met several times with Ralph Bakshi, whose film, Fritz the Cat, had been the first animation to receive an X rating. Bakshi gave me a super funny script, but nothing ever materialized. I think he might have wanted to get in my pants, which did not happen. Paramount had made zillions from the Eddie Murphy movies when Beverly Hills Cop 2 opened with a record-breaking $26.4 million box office. Bob Wax threw a huge celebration for Eddie at his house in Beverly Hills. It was my first big Hollywood party, an all-day barbecue featuring all-day drinking. I felt a bit out of place and didn't socialize much. However, I managed to down 2 margaritas when I arrived, drank a couple of glasses of red wine with dinner, and when they brought out this giant cake, I enjoyed a